from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, award-winning novelist Ann Patchett will join us in studio to discuss her most recent novel, State of Wonder, which takes us from the cold Midwest world of Minnesota to the hot Amazon jungle in a remote part of Brazil. It's her sixth novel, and it's one she fully intended to be both a page-turning mystery and a work of high literary quality. Ann Patchett, next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Nashville-based best-selling and award-winning writer Ann Patchett takes us from the chilly cold of Minnesota to a steamy, insect-infested, heart-of-darkness South American jungle of cannibals and anaconda in her new novel, State of Wonder. It's her sixth novel, and it centers on a 42-year-old named Marina Singh, a research physician for a large Minnesota-based pharmaceutical company whose friend and colleague appears to have died in the Amazon, where mysterious research has been underway under the assumed command of a strange and formidable former mentor and teacher of Marina's. Research that could mean fertility for women into their postmenopausal years. Ann Patchett is author of the novels Run, The Patron Saint of Liars, Taft, The Magician's Assistant, and Bel Canto, which won the Penn Faulkner Award, the Orange Prize, and the Book Sense Book Year of the Year Award. She's also author of the nonfiction works Truth and Beauty and What Now, and she's written for The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, Gourmet, The New York Times Magazine, Vogue, and The Washington Post, and joins us for the second hour forum. Good to see you again.
Hi, glad to be here.
I didn't know if you were going to come back and visit us again. I know you hate book tours, but here you are on another book tour.
I go where they tell me to go.
Yes, it's all robotic, isn't it? All in the best interest of this book. And this book is, it's about teaching in many respects, isn't it? And it's about the relationship that one has, whether one knows it or not, sometimes in a lifetime, especially when one comes back and meets a former teacher or mentor.
Absolutely. And that was where this whole thing started for me, because I had some incredibly important teachers in my life at Sarah Lawrence when I was an undergraduate. And people,
including our friend Grace Paley.
Friend Grace Paley, Alan Gurganis, more than anyone, Russell Banks. But they were people that I absolutely shaped myself to be someone who would please them, not to be like them, but to be someone that they might like. And of course, a teacher has thousands of students, and they don't know you. You know, you want to please them and be with them and impress them, but of course, you're just one more face in the crowd.
I had actually on a book tour, I had a funny encounter with a student who came up to me and said, "You probably don't remember me," and I didn't. But I was in your class, it was many years ago, I think 30 or some big number like that, and it was very moving. You inspired me to become a teacher, and I said, "Where are you teaching?" "I've retired."
Oh, my gosh.
So it's one of those moments where I thought, whoa.
I missed the whole story. And I've had that also with former students, you know, coming up to me in a signing line. I don't know their name. I don't know their face. And they say, "I was on my way to medical school, and I took your fiction class, and I decided that I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a teacher." And I always think, it's amazing your parents didn't hunt me down and kill me.
Modesty. This is also, though, a book where you're back working with science, in a sense.
Yeah.
It's a lot about pharmaceuticals, in fact, because your protagonist has these terrible anti-malarial-induced pills that cause nightmares. And then we're looking for this, as I mentioned in the introduction, this fabulous way to make women pregnant for the rest of their lives, possibly.
Yes.
You did a lot of research. In fact, I think, was it Gourmet magazine that took you down the Amazon?
Yeah. Boy, those were the good old days. I miss Gourmet so much. I wrote for them for 10 years. You must know Ruth Reichel.
Yeah, Ruth has been on the program. In fact, the last time she was on the program, she got the news after she was on the program that they were closing their doors, ironically.
That was a terrible day. But those people were so much fun to work with. And I could call them for anything and say, you know, I want to go. When I was working on Bel Canto, I wanted to go to Italy to see the great opera houses. And they said, oh, what a terrific idea for an article, and sent me off to Italy. So when I was in the middle of this book and I wanted to go to the Amazon, they sent me down to the Amazon. And it's not that I mind paying for my own travel. It's that I can't figure out how to book a trip to the, you know, middle, the really obscure part of the Amazon, and they were geniuses at that.
And you went there for, what, 10 days?
About 10 days. And for 3 days, I loved it. For 3 days, I thought it was the most spectacular, beautiful place I'd ever seen in my life. And by about the eighth day, I would have sold my left arm to get out of there.
Or your soul.
So I backed it up a little bit, but yes.
Well, because we get kind of echoes of Marlowe and Kurtz and the jungle, the heart of darkness, the Conrad world here in this novel. And did you have that feeling when you were down there?
You know, the thing that was my main influence are the Werner Herzog movies, Aguirre, the Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo. My entire vision of the jungle is Herzog's vision of the jungle, because that's where I first saw it in those movies. And there were a lot of other influences, too. The Evelyn Waugh novel, Handful of Dust, where
it's a wonderful novel.
The guy has to read the Dickens over and over again.
Not The Island of Dr. Moreau? Or?
A Little Island of Dr. Moreau. Of course, Lord of the Flies shows up in everything I do. I'm a compost pit. I read all of this stuff. I see the movies. I meet people. It rots. I forget about it. It mulches together. And that's where the books grow.
It's funny when you mention Lord of the Flies, though. I mean, I can see the analogies, but in so many ways, you're such a more optimistic writer than the likes of William Golding.
Oh, yes. Yes, I am. I'm a more optimistic writer than the likes of Joseph Conrad and probably even Lemoyne, too.
Well, you are an optimistic writer, in fact.
I'm an optimistic person. I'm a little ray of sunshine here in the radio studio.
You have good set points.
Thank you.
And it comes across. It always comes across. Why the Amazon? Why'd you want to go there?
I needed malaria. Malaria plays a big role in this book. And so I got out the globe and I looked at the places that had malaria. And I also wanted a bait and switch. So I wanted a drug company that was supporting what would be an incredibly lucrative drug. But in fact, they're working on a drug that's not going to make them any money at all, which was a vaccine for malaria. So I needed a place that had both malaria and great medical possibilities. And I very quickly X'd out Africa and India and Indonesia and wound up in the Amazon.
You wanted a place that was remote and maybe not accessible as far as technology? I mean, Marina loses her satellite phone early on. I don't want to give anything away here, but it seems like you wanted to place her in a position where she didn't have much to rely upon.
But that is such a huge thing for me. I have an 8-year-old flip phone. I am on the road checking my email once every 3 days in the hotel business center, which I've got to tell you is a great place. No one uses the hotel business center anymore. There's no one there. I don't know how to write a novel in which people have cell phones and which people can Google anything. How do you make a plot go forward if every character is constantly available to every other character? It makes no sense to me. And so I'm constantly bending myself into knots, trying to figure out a way to separate my characters from technology. So, you know, yes, you can have your character lose their phone, but then you have to put them someplace where there's not going to be a Verizon store so they can't replace it.
I was in Cuba recently. You can't have cell service there. It just doesn't work. I mean, American cell phones don't
even
work.
The global satellite
phone? Well, a global satellite phone might work. I don't know. I didn't have one, but, you know, there are long lines in the business centers as a result in the hotel. Why create a protagonist who's part American, part Indian? I mean, you were sort of flirting, it seemed to me, with the idea of Obama there, because you mentioned that hybrid identity.
It wasn't really Obama, but Morena's father is East Indian. He's from Calcutta. And so I needed that for the malaria, because as a child, she took larium whenever she went to India. So I wanted her to have a basis in larium. Also, she deeply loves Minnesota. That is her home. It is the place she feels so comfortable. But she is dark. And so her entire life, wherever she goes, the blondes are always turning around and looking at her, and she doesn't feel entirely at home in her own extended family of blondes because her mother is from Minnesota.
She's the llama.
She's the llama, the visiting llama, exactly. And yet when she goes to the Amazon, where she does not want to go, and she feels incredibly uncomfortable, for the first time in her life, people don't turn around and look at her.
Talking with Ann Patchett, her new novel is State of Wonder. The Larium Nightmares, I find myself reflecting on that a lot because, those of us who've grown up on Freud, that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, as he put it, and so forth. And yet you can have nightmares induced and repeated nightmares like she does as a result of certain kind of pharmacological effects.
Oh, absolutely. There are all sorts of drugs that will give you bad dreams. And I took Larium when I went down to the Amazon. And it was interesting because I was sort of hoping that I would have some sort of psychosis just to experiment with it. And frankly, even if I hadn't gone to the
Amazon, disappointed that
I was a little disappointed. I would have just taken them in Nashville. But I did have a very strange reaction called Stevens-Johnson syndrome, where the entire inside of my mouth and throat blistered and peeled off because of the Larium. So there are no end of interesting things that can happen to you when you take Larium.
That's not necessarily a recommendation.
Well, you know what was rough about it was I was on assignment for Gourmet, and it was the equivalent of scalding your tongue with a cup of coffee. I couldn't taste anything for weeks. So I'm down there and I'm supposed to be eating the food to earn my keep, and I can't taste anything.
When we first meet Marina, you actually say Marina. How do you say her
I
name?
I say Marina, but
Marina,
say whatever
yeah.
you like.
Okay, we'll call her Marina. Then the author has privilege here. When we first meet her, she's having an affair with the CEO of her company, whose name is Mr. Fox, actually Jim Fox, but she calls him Mr. Fox. And there's definitely an age difference there. There's a kind of you almost sense that this is an affair that really has no passion to it. And that's what you wanted to portray it as?
You know, they have a little passion. It's an okay relationship. And Mr. Fox is a good person. She's a good person. They're not a perfect match. It's not a great love, but it is not a bad relationship. And I think the point is,
it's kind of friends with benefits or something?
It's a little better than that. But when we're in our 20s, when we're in our 30s, if it's not a great relationship, we dump it and move on. When we're 42 and we may possibly want to have a child, and this relationship is not perfect, but it's pretty good, then you try to stick it out. And that's where Marina is with that relationship.
Of course, you've talked publicly about the fact that you have made the choice not to have a child. And
right.
One doesn't want to get into psychobiography, but you think, would you want the opportunity to keep this choice for the rest of your life by having some tree bark that would allow you to get postmenopausal pregnancy?
Would I personally?
You'd like it for women. Would you like it for your gender?
No, I would not. Not personally, nor for my gender, because another literary influence of this novel is Pinocchio. And Pinocchio thought it would be great to never go to school and to eat candy all day and shoot pool. And we all know what happened with Pinocchio. And I do think in our society, there's this idea that you can put your choices off forever and the doors are always open to you. I met a woman recently who was in her 40s and was a very beautiful actress, and she said, I'm going to have my eggs frozen because I'm not ready to make a decision yet. And I thought, you know, that in itself is a decision. And so this is a sort of cautionary tale. What if we all get our wish, our medical wish, and we can put our decisions off forever? It actually doesn't look that great.
Now, speaking about Pinocchio, it's a testament to what a good liar you are, as any fiction writer worth his or her salt is, because there are people who, it's like Shirley Jackson when she wrote The Lottery. They thought people read the story and thought those lotteries where they stoned people to death really took place. People read you and they think this tribe actually exists. And the research exists.
That is astonishing. And that takes me back to the whole obsession with smartphones and Google, because I think that people believe now now that everything can be discovered. If you just Google it, you know, it's there somewhere, and it's taken the place of imagination. But no, I made this tribe up. My husband helped me a lot with that. We would sit up at night.
He is a physician.
He's a physician trying to figure out, you know, okay, they chew a bark, they chew the tree, there's a moth, the moth lays the eggs in the tree. It took a long time to come up with this. And then I named them after my favorite breakfast cereal, Kashi.
And you've got this character, Dr. Swenson, who is quite a character, in fact. I mean, I imagine a composite of many strong women you've known and also probably strong men, I would at least venture. But she's an enigma in many ways. And as we learn more about her, we learn about a kind of strong woman, the likes of which, well, I mean, you love her because she's your character, but she may be harder to love than many characters, isn't she?
Actually, I do really love her. For one thing, she was a blast to write. And I've spent 17 years with my husband and doctor friends listening to horror stories about medical school and internships and residency, which is a system that seems to be based on fraternity hazing. It's just cruelty for the sake of cruelty. So to bring in this character who lays down the law for no apparent reason and everyone must do what she says, that's a really fun character to write. But
boy, she's tough. She's imperious and tough, both.
Yeah. She is, and she doesn't suffer fools gladly. She is not a villain. She is not a bad person. No. But she has a very clear eye, and she's going to do what needs to be done, and that's all there is to it. And frankly, I've got a lot of that in me. I mean, I work by myself. I live by my own laws. And I'm extremely clear. I have a friend who always says,
"You don't have the hardness, really."
You know, you don't know me all that well.
When you talked about not liking book tours, you said, "I have to put on this other face. I have to put on this other persona and everything." And now you're presenting yourself as somebody behind that mask, maybe, who's much tougher.
You know what? I don't like book tour because I don't like getting on an airplane every single day of my life. I actually do really like meeting people and talking to people. But I am someone who's very clear. And I have a friend who always says, there's the truth and then there's the Patchett truth, which I kind of will cut down to it pretty quickly.
And is that spelled P-A-T-C-H-I-T, Patchett truth?
That's very clever.
I'm talking to Ann Patchett, by the way. Her new book is State of Wonder. It is, in fact, it's intentionally a kind of page-turner that you've written here that's a thriller, really. A mystery and a thriller at the same time, but also you've got literary chops, and there's so that hybridization.
Absolutely. I love it when somebody comes up to me and says, I started your book and I was up all night. I'm a big Raymond Chandler fan, and I like to always have a hook at the end of a chapter in all of my books, sometimes more successfully than others. But I want people to keep reading. I want people to want to know what's going to happen.
You want to do what Barbara Kingsolver once said to me? I want to keep people awake at night, make sure that they don't go to sleep.
Yes, that's exactly right.
The book, again, is State of Wonder. We should mention, by the way, that Ann Patchett will be at Book Passage later today in Corte Madera at 12:30, and she'll also be at Kepler's Books tonight in Menlo Park at 7 o'clock. And you can certainly avail yourself of the opportunity to speak with her. I know there are many fans of her work out there. And in fact, talk about fans of your work. I'm going to give out the phone number in just a moment, mm-hmm. but Renee Fleming, who's been on this program, has become a close friend of yours as a result of Bel Canto.
Yes, it's true, because everybody thinks that that's a book about Renee. And in fact, Renee and I often say that it was a character that was based on Renee, because I've been hearing it for so long. But I met her after I finished the book, and she's a great friend of mine. She's a spectacular person.
I need to make a correction here. It says 12:30 on my sheet, but it's actually noon. You'll be at Book Passage.
I guess I got to hustle on out there.
Corrected. Yeah, get you out of the door very quickly. By the way, if you'd like to join us with Ann Patchett, you're certainly cordially invited to do so. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. And that number is available whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Please feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the conversation. And you can also, well, let us know what you think or raise questions or comments by email, forum@kqed.org, or you can post questions or comments on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this particular segment. I've also got I've touched on some of the main characters. This character, Easter, and I was interested in sort of the genesis of this, a mute boy whom we meet in the Amazon.
Interesting genesis, actually. When I was on book tour for Run, I was at the National Cathedral in Washington giving a talk, and a woman came up to me in the signing line, and she said that she was an interpreter for the deaf. And she said, I would really like to see a deaf character in a book, and that it's not a book about being deaf. It's not a book about being handicapped. I would just like to see somebody deaf in a story and have it be no big deal. And I said, oh, I can do that. That's not a problem. And the great sadness in all of that is I lost the woman's business card. And so I don't have any idea who it was. And I can only hope that at some point she picks the book up and reads it. And
she may be listening as we're speaking.
It
who
could
knows?
Be.
She could have moved to Northern California.
I hope.
One never
I hope
knows.
She did.
Talk about the title, State of Wonder.
Oh, the title was just a complete heartbreaker. I could not come up with a title for this book. Or, to put it another way, I came up with 75 titles for this book. Every day I came up with three titles and would put it out to everyone I knew, and people would just shoot them down and say what horrible titles I had come up with. And this was the Hail Mary pass. I mean, the book was practically going to press in 2 days. Mm. And I came up with this title, and I'm thrilled because I think it's a great title
I
for this
works.
Book.
Yeah.
I'm very happy. I wanted a title that sort of sat above the book, didn't reference to anything in particular, but had the feeling of what this experience was like for Morena.
Some people think State of Wonder and it takes place in the Amazon, they're going to think ayahuasca, you know, or some kind of special substance along those lines. But I think it is because it suggests awe and it suggests almost a kind of childhood awe of being. And that's really what you are getting. You're also getting at, in fact, let me talk to you about this. How much are you getting at is the way I'd phrase it. This curious relationship between pharmaceutical companies and the third world or, you know, the natives and indigenous people. I mean, some would say it's really quite exploitative. And there are ethnobotanists, I know, for example, come to mind. Well, not mention names here, but, you know, who are very critical of the pharmaceutical companies for these kind of exploitation.
There's certainly a long history of people going in and taking what they want back to the seeds of the rubber trees taken over to England. I think that people have exploited people throughout the world for monetary gain, and it can't all be pinned on the pharmaceutical industry. And I'll tell you, I'm more interested in the fact that the drugs that are being developed are so often drugs like this, a drug for fertility. It's not going to save anybody's life. That's not an important drug, as opposed to putting money into AIDS or malaria and things that the poor people really need and they're not going to get because there's no profit in it.
But you're not on a political horse here, really.
No, this is not The Constant Gardener, which is a book that I love that really takes the pharmaceutical companies apart. No, I mean, this is a business, and they're trying to make money, and they're really not doing anything wrong.
Talking again with Ann Patchett, and the book is State of Wonder. And I'm going to, again, open up our phone lines. We're coming toward a break. If you'd like to talk to Ann Patchett, this is certainly a splendid opportunity for you to do so. All you need to do is call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. She'll be at Book Passage again at noon today in Corte Madera, and later on this evening at Kepler's Books over in Menlo Park at 7 o'clock. There's so much to talk to you about. You know? I mean, I'm going to just go to the break and let the listeners have a go at what's on their minds. Again, we'll continue our conversation after the break. And stay tuned, because Ann Patchett's going to spend the hour with us. Her new book, State of Wonder, it's a thriller. It sends a pharmaceutical research scientist into the depths of the Amazon jungle. Acclaimed author of the best-selling Bel Canto. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Thank you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with best-selling and award-winning novelist Ann Patchett, who's also written nonfiction, by the way, and talk a little bit about how the two differ for you.
Sure. Nonfiction is not a problem, and fiction really is. And that's kind of what it boils down to for me. Not for other people. Fiction is just very hard for me. In fiction, you have to create the world. You have to answer every single question. Where does the story end? Who is it about? When do they live? When do they die? How does it end? Where do they go? What's the moral? In nonfiction, it seems like those questions are answered. You pick a subject and the facts define where you're going and what the structure is. And it becomes more a matter of purely writing. And writing is something that, you know, I've been doing for a long time. I'm pretty good at.
Are you in a different state of consciousness, though, when you write fiction? Some characterize it as a kind of altered state or anything like that, as opposed to the facts, just the facts, ma'am?
I would say I am not in an altered state of consciousness. My husband, were he here, he would say definitely that I was and that I would walk into doors. We talk about this a lot. I think this is my job and I'm working and I have both hands on the wheel all the time. But he would say that I shouldn't be allowed to drive a car when I'm writing a novel.
Let's go to some of our callers. And Margarita, you're on with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm so thrilled to be speaking with you. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to know how much background information do you work on when you develop your characters? How long do you build them in your head, or how much work do you have to do to develop them?
I know them really, really well, and I love to think about people for a long time, sometimes a year or two before I start writing a book, and that's always the happiest part of work for me. For example, right now I have just a little germ of a novel in my head, and when I'm on airplanes, waiting in airports, checking into hotel rooms, what I'm usually thinking about are the people who are going to be in the next book that I write. I don't take notes. There's nothing structured about it, but I just, you know, kind of daydream about them. It's like a kid with an invisible friend.
Thank you for the call, Margarita. We'll get another caller on. Nancy, join us. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine. We can hear you fine.
Okay, I can't hear you. All right.
That's odd, but go ahead, please.
Okay, sure. I just wanted to tell Ann Patchett that Bel Canto is one of my favorite books ever. I remember exactly I was reading it in Lithia Park in Ashland, Oregon on a bench, and when I finished it, I just sat there and wept. And the singer who I thought of was Ruth Ann Swenson because she's my favorite
she's
soprano.
She's fantastic.
And I just absolutely love that book. I talked to everybody I knew that they had to read it. And I've read other of your books, and the last book I read was Run. And to me, that just wasn't nearly as successful as Bel Canto.
You can't win every time, you know?
No,
and it's so
absolutely
interesting because there are people
who will tell you, I love Run, but I didn't love Bel
absolutely
Canto.
And the book that people always love straight across the board, Magician's Assistant. So you never know, but I'm glad you liked that one. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Does it concern you that I read somewhere where 98% of your readers are women?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it
you
doesn't.
You didn't know that?
It doesn't concern me.
I don't know how one measures or quantifies that, but would you want, I mean, how would, do you think about wanting male readers? Or
you know, no one has the perfect career, right? Stephen King wants to win more prizes. You know, people who win all the prizes would like to have more readers.
Actually, I've discovered people who have more literary prizes want more money, and people who have more money want more literary prizes.
That's true. And I try very hard to not get into that. If women read me, I'm very grateful for that. And I have the experience often that a man will be interviewing me or writing a piece about me in the newspaper, and he'll say, I never would have read your books. I thought they were books for women. And I read them and I love them, and they're not. They're books for men too. And why is it I didn't know that? Why haven't I not had access to it? Who knows? It doesn't make any difference.
Who knows? Let's go to some emails here. And by the way, you can email us forum at kqed.org or post something on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or, by the way, join us by phone, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Christy writes, your guest appears to have never been in Minnesota, or at least not the huge Twin Cities area, which is no different from the Bay Area in terms of ethnic and racial diversity. So a person with dark skin is not going to feel the least bit out of place. Minnesota is not all about Garrison Keillor's hometown. As a former Minnesotan, I bristle at the stereotype. If you don't share this on air, please at least pass this on to her. Well, it's been shared. And you say what?
I say I'm very sorry, and I guess I'm thinking more in terms of Marina in her own large extended family going to family functions. But gosh, I was just in the Twin Cities about a month ago and looked real blonde. But I it may just be the people who showed up for my talk.
Well, you could have put her in Iowa. That would have been safer, maybe. I mean, in terms of feeling particularly out because of the dark skin. Now people from Iowa are going to say, well, come on, we've got ethnic diversity. But last time I was in Iowa, it looked pretty white to Brett. Here's a listener, Lizzie, who says, Bel Canto is one of my favorite books and loosely based on a true story. I'm wondering if Anne took inspiration from true life stories for her new book.
No, I really didn't. I made it all up.
Here's Greg who says, tell your guest to give her characters AT&T cell service to resolve the problem of them being constantly available to one another.
That's a good
practical
tip.
Solution.
I think that's terrific. Let me tell you a story really quickly. When I was in the Amazon and there was a day that we took an open boat 3 hours into the jungle and then hiked 2 hours to go look at the giant lily pads. And we were as far away from humanity as you could get. And one of the people in the group of 10 got a cell phone call from his golf partner in Orlando asking if he could make a 2 o'clock tea time. And I thought I was going to take the guy's phone and throw it into the giant lily pads.
It's a funny story, though. I mean, of all the places to suddenly think about golf, you did have an encounter with an anaconda.
I did. I was in one of those open boats on another day, and one of the guests reached into the river, and there were about 8 of us in the boat, and pulled a 15-foot anaconda in the boat.
That like? Tell us.
You know, it's really unpleasant, and I'm not a snake phobe, but you really want to get out of the boat, and there is really no place to go. And it turns out, I didn't know it at the time, this man was a naturalist. He was a professional snake handler. He went all over the world picking up snakes. There was not a bird or a plant or an insect he didn't know everything about. Incredibly competent. Greg Greer in Atlanta. If you ever need a snake handler, you'll know where to find him. And he kept the snake in the boat for 20 minutes and gave us a interesting lecture on the snake while the snake was trying to eat his head. And then he unwrapped himself and put it back in the water. And when I wrote the snake scene in the book, called Greg, and he was a big help.
Speaking about Atlanta and Minnesota and all these different places that dot our landscape, you have decided to make your roots in Nashville. Why?
Well, I'm from Nashville. I grew
originally
up there.
Yeah.
And I moved back there when I was 30 and started dating the man who became my husband. He's a doctor. He's got a big practice there. My family's there. I live down the street from my mother and stepfather. Carl's kids
are
there.
So it's roots.
You know, we're Amish at this point. You know, we have the whole family in this 5-block
radius. Got a buggy,
radius,
too?
Pretty much, right.
We'll bring some more callers on for Ann Patchett. Christopher, join us. You're on.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to quickly ask, and forgive me for not tuning in a bit earlier to the first segment of your show. Maybe you may have revealed this, but I was curious to ask your guest whether or not the inspiration of the deaf character in the new book was based on anyone in particular or was just drawn out of thin air. I myself am a child of deaf parents.
Oh, no. As I said in the beginning of the story, actually, I met someone who was an interpreter who said, I would really like you to just put a deaf character in the book and not have it be about being deaf. But what I want to ask you is, have you read a book called The Hands of My Father?
No, I certainly haven't.
You must find it. And I can't remember the author's name. It is such a beautiful, beautiful book about being the hearing child of deaf parents. It's fantastic. You'll really enjoy it.
Oh, thank you very much for the recommendation.
Sure.
I definitely remember the hands of my father trying to teach me how to drive stick.
Ah, there you go.
That was a difficult task.
Thank you, Christopher. Good to hear from you this morning. This is Jane in Modesto, who says, I love the book you wrote about your writer friend. Your portrayal of her was honest, and the description of a friendship that had its benefits and drawbacks spoke to me and some relationships I've experienced and observed. Always nice to hear.
Yes, I appreciate that very much.
Myron Ulberg is the author of Hands of My Father. Thank you, Kevin, for that. Get that on the air. And we'll get Neil on the air as well. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah. What authors inspired you? Particularly, do you have any opinion of Graham Greene?
I'm a big fan of Graham Greene. I think that probably everybody inspires me. The people who inspired me the most are the people that I read when I was young. I think that the older we get, the more calcified we are, and we can be incredibly moved by authors, but not so much inspired. The people that my parents were reading when I was in junior high and high school, John Updike, Philip Roth, especially Saul Bellow. I can remember reading all of Saul Bellow's books when I was in high school, and they don't seem like particularly appropriate choices for high school girls, but those were the books that really influenced me because they were the authors that I was reading when I was young.
It's interesting.
Any particular Greene novels?
The Third Man, I love. The End of the Affair. Our Man in Havana. Which was a book that I read when I was writing this book. But, you know, if you're Catholic and you're a novelist, you're going to go to Graham Greene. I've never been someone who connected with Flannery O'Connor. It was always Graham Greene for me.
Thank you for the call. How important is Catholicism to you as a writer?
Well, as a writer, I'm glad you said that, because if you'd asked me how important it was to me as a person, I don't think I would have done a great job. As a writer, it's an incredible religion. I highly recommend it for all young writers because it's such a fantasy-based religion and a story-based religion. And the idea that, you know, St. Francis takes the end of his little sack of grain and puts it out for the birds, and the birds all bring back 10 sacks of grain, one little grain at a time. Those are great stories to hear when you're a kid because it helps you think in terms of story, which I think is a wonderful benefit of religion.
So it's the narratives. It's the myths and the narratives.
Absolutely. Yeah. And strong characters.
And strong characters. from Catholic girlhood, who comes to mind in that strong character context?
Are you talking about which
stories, yeah.
Which Catholic figures?
Yeah.
I was always a great fan of Joseph. You know, he was the guy in the background just doing the work, never getting the credit. When I think about going to church when I was a kid and you go and kneel in front of a certain statue, you know, I always wanted to go and kneel in front of St. Joseph because I always felt like he wasn't getting his due. He wasn't getting
too
as much
emphasis
credit.
On Mary.
Too much emphasis on Mary. She was getting all the credit. You know, here she's pregnant. He marries her. He completely believes it's the child of God, sticks by her. I think that's a beautiful saint.
You never accepted parthenogenesis?
I've struggled with that, actually. And that, of course, must figure into this book, too, right?
It does, indeed. I was thinking along those lines, in fact. What kind of research did you do for this book? I mean, other than going to the Amazon, and I mean, you must have been reading some, fairly up-to-date scientific research, at least from the way I read your book.
The best day that I had was I went to the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland and spent an entire day with the head malarialist, the guy who's working on developing the vaccines, who was so incredibly generous. One of the great truths I have discovered about human nature as a novelist is that people really want to share their work. And you can go to almost anyone and say, I am very interested in what you do, and I want you to just tell me about it. And people are really happy.
That's what I do almost every day.
Yeah, I know, but I seek them out. They're seeking you out. But I go out there, and he showed me all the mosquitoes. He explained malaria. He explained the process of how they develop the vaccines and what's working and what looks promising. Wonderful, generous Dr. Tom Ritchie. I also went and sat in on a cesarean section, which I found much more terrifying than someone dragging a 15-foot anaconda.
I read that you fainted, in fact? Or,
I did. Yeah. Not till the very end, I like to say. The child was out and everything was being closed up, but I had no idea. I had already written the cesarean scene in the book, and I really just wanted to go and check myself. And it was so much more physical and more brutal than I had ever thought possible.
Well, as you just intimated, Caesarion plays a very important role in this novel in many ways, not
yes.
only in terms of both the narrative action and in terms of the past, not giving anything away. But what drew you to that?
My friend, the surgeon who brought me in on this particular Caesarion, had told me years ago that she was doing a very, very fast Caesarion. It was an emergency. And she had cut too deeply and cut through the baby's eyelid, just the eyelid in that story. And that always stuck with me. And it was a very small deal, but she was extremely shaken by it. There's a term, and I can't remember, I use it in the book, when the baby is face up and you don't know when you're doing a cesarean. And yeah, when I was putting this book together, I remember that story from years ago.
Talking to Ann Patchett, her new book, State of Wonder. Again, she'll be in Corte Madera later on this afternoon at noon at Book Passage and at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park this evening, 7 o'clock. And she's here with us talking about State of Wonder and talking about her. Well, we haven't talked that much about your writing career. They all are your children, huh?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, I make them, but I forget about them.
Really? You neglect them? You abandon them?
I do. I'm like a turtle, lays the eggs on the sand and crawls away. When I finish a book, and I mean finish it, I mean copy editing, every single thing that needs to be done is done. There is a period of time, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, that I care about the book. And I care what people think, and it matters. And when that period of time is over, which is long before it's published, I make a break with it. And I don't really ever think about it. I've never read any of my books again after that time. And I'm on to something else. And I feel like if the bear runs into last year's litter, probably doesn't even recognize them anymore. And I feel a little bit that way about my books.
Do you feel then that there is validity in these kind of metaphors? One often hears about, you know, a book gestates and one gives birth to the book and all that.
No, actually, that always makes me a little uncomfortable. I think that people who feel sorry for me because I don't have children will often say, oh, well, your books are your children. Or worse yet, they will say, your dog is your child. But no, my dog is my dog and my books are my books. And I understand that there's a difference.
It's also kind of off-putting, isn't it, when people assume somehow that you must be incomplete because you didn't have children, or maybe there's something wrong with your fertility, or who the hell knows what they think, right? But
yeah,
they often think on those lines, don't they?
Part of the energy of this story comes out of that. I actually was somebody who knew probably when I was in junior high school that I wasn't going to have kids. I just never have wanted children. My mother always said that when my sister and I were little, my sister always wanted baby dolls and I always wanted stuffed animals. The baby dolls gave me the creeps. I just don't have it in me. And that's fine. I'm really comfortable with that.
Wasn't but, wanting to be a nun, perhaps, or anything like that.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that. I just, I'm very neat and I'm very quiet, and I don't know. I just never wanted children. But for my entire life, I've had people, both people who don't know me and people who know me very well, say, "You're going to change your mind. You better go ahead and have a kid, because later on, when you can't have them, you're going to really miss it. It's going to be this terrible loss for you," and it's strange to be involved in an endless conversation about such a personal choice. One of the great things about being 47 is that people don't say that to me anymore.
A little stubbornness in you when you were younger than that, saying, I want to prove that I'm right about this, that I knew exactly what I wanted all along and they don't know. No, it was just you.
No, I mean, you. It's like I never wanted a Ferrari either. I know.
That's funny. Neither did I. talking to Ann Patchett. Again, her new book is State of Wonder. And I'm going to go to some of your emails here. But first, I need to ask, talking before about Graham Greene and Sal Bellow and all the, what contemporary writers do you read?
Oh, gosh. I read my friends. That's what I immediately go to when I am
fiction
asked
writers
that question.
Mainly, you're talking?
Fiction writers and nonfiction. Liz Gilbert is a great friend of mine. Jane Hamilton, I love her novels. Donna Tartt, who I think is the genius of certainly my generation. Elizabeth McCracken. These are the people. Miley Malloy. Oh, Miley Malloy. Have you ever read Miley Malloy?
No, I'm not. Who's Miley Malloy?
She is a great short story writer and also a great novelist. Her last book was called Both Ways is the Only Way I Want It. Mm. Publishes a lot in The New Yorker. I don't think that there's a short story writer out there who touches her.
Alice Munro?
She's as good as Alice Munro.
Really?
She really is. There's, I shouldn't say that, but Alice Munro is so fabulous and Miley is still young. She's fantastic. A writer who I adore named Kevin Wilson, who has a novel coming out in August called The Family Fang, which is one of the best books I've read in ages. So
I look for it. Thank you.
Very excited about the work my friends are doing.
These are great tips. We do a whole hour where we just have people calling in with tips of, you know, must reads or great reads or and fiction and nonfiction. Here's Sarah, who says, there's a scene at an opera in the middle of the jungle in State of Wonder. And of course, opera is an integral part of Bel Canto. Are you a big opera fan, or does opera represent something in a literary sense to you?
I'm a big opera fan. And when I wrote Bel Canto, I really didn't have any background in opera. I was scrambling and learning. And in the last 10 years, I feel like I've spent 9 of those years at the opera, and I am very up to speed. So I wanted to have a small opera scene in a book now that I know what I'm talking about. But also, of course, Fitzcarraldo, my favorite Werner Herzog movie, begins in the opera house in Manaus. And so I feel like I am so indebted to Herzog. I wanted to have that little opera house scene as my nod.
It's a Herzog tribute.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the same listener says you briefly mentioned that some of the characters of Fitzcarraldo and then the opera that Marina attends is Orpheus and Eurydice. Thank you. Eurydice. These both seem like pretty blatant commentaries on your book. Was that intentional?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, going back to the title, the original title that I had for the book, which I knew that I would never use, was Orpheus in the Jungle. But I felt like anybody who really understood the Orpheus story, it would give too much away.
The same listener, by the way, says, I love your book. Our fledgling book club picked it as our second book, and I am so glad.
Oh, thank you. Book club, hardback. Good for you.
Another listener says, Fran, from the rejoicing throngs of Nashville book lovers, thank you, thank you, thank you for your plans to make us once again a city with a great independent bookstore. When is opening day? I will be the first in line to buy State of Wonder, and thanks to for the wonderful, many wonderful stories. What's she talking about?
I am opening a bookstore.
You and Louise Erdrich. Huh?
Yes, I'm following in Louise's footsteps. We don't have an opening date. Hopefully we will be up and running by Christmas. And I should say up front, I am partnering with a wonderful, smart woman named Karen Hayes, who actually knows what she's doing.
Want a recommendation? When you're at Book Passage, ask to talk to Elaine Petrucelli.
I know, you know Elaine. Elaine very well, but she's out of town, so she won't be there. But anyway, we're opening a store.
Congratulations. It's good for you.
I know. We lost our independent bookstore. Then we lost our Borders. In the last 6 months, we have some used bookstores, which frankly don't do me any good. And here I've made this beautiful book. I've got this thing to sell and no place to sell it. So Karen knows a lot about the book business and about stores. And I am funding it and I am promoting it and we are partners.
Well, bravo.
Thank you.
We're big supporters of independent bookstores. Marcia says, I have to smile at Ms. Patchett's Google comments. I was going to look up whether there really were Lakashi people. Now that I know their name for breakfast food, I'm laughing at myself and our social dependence on the internet. That's from Marcia.
Thanks, Marcia.
And she also wrote, oh, I just finished State of Wonder yesterday. I bought it for my husband for Father's Day and couldn't help sneak reading it myself. We both love Bel Canto, and this book does not disappoint. Did Ms. Patchett deliberately leave the complicated dream about Marina's father vague? I wasn't sure about the horror there.
Well,
it's pretty specific as when I read it. I mean, I didn't think it was vague.
Good, good. That's good. I really, really just wanted them to be about the Larium and about sort of the intersection of the past and the present. And when I first wrote the book, those dreams were long. They were a huge part of the book. And when Elizabeth McCracken read it, and she is my number one editor, she said, you've got to get rid of these dreams. You've got to cut them back. And so I dumped about 98% of the dreams in the book.
So how much do your friends and editors affect the final product that you put out?
My friends are my editors. And that has to do with the fact that I'm a good student. And when I hand my homework in, I want it to be perfect. I always want to hand in a book that the editor says, oh my gosh, there's nothing for me to do. And so I rely heavily on my friends. And really, it's...
And vice versa?
Yes. Oh, gosh, yes. But it's kind of like the gifts from the fairy godmothers. Each friend brings something very specific and gives me a completely different piece of advice. And I'll tell you, the really great gift is Jane Hamilton, who has me read my books aloud to her when I finish them. And we lie on the couch together, and she's there with her eyes closed, and I'm reading. I read State of Wonder to her in 2 days, 2 12-hour days we read that book. And every now and then she will raise her hand. She calls me Mrs. Van Devender, which is actually my last name. And she'll say, oh, Mrs. Van Devender, that's a terrible sentence. Take that out, Mrs. Van Devender. You can't keep that in the book. And I'll scratch it out. And five minutes later.
Mr. Fox.
Exactly. 5 minutes later, she'll say, oh, Mrs. Van Devender, you used the word banana 50 pages ago. You can't use the word banana again. And it's fantastic. You have to read a book aloud. And it's wonderful if you have somebody who will listen to you.
It's almost, I mean, the way you describe it, it really is a close, intimate kind of bonding, too. I mean, you're reading the book aloud. She's interrupting. You're lying on the couch.
We're eating Good and Plenty's.
Oh, those too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know that you can take the box of Good and Plenty's and make it into a whistle? Did you know that? Did you
know
that as a kid?
Oh,
that's
no,
one of those things from my misspent youth. No, you could. I'll show you sometime.
I've eaten a lot of Good and Plenty's, so I'm glad to know that
there's
something.
Now that I'm diabetic, I can't eat as many.
Oh,
I can't
I'm
eat
sorry.
Them at all. No, it's one of the great losses, Good and Plenty's, of course. You can also take the pink ones and suck on them, and they turn white.
I'm going to leave this radio station and go.
You're so much more educated
there.
Than you were when you came in.
It's true. And you know, it's so hard because I think that there are only about 4 Americans who still eat Good and Plenty's, that when you find a box of them, which is very rare, they're usually 10 years old. And
no,
have
they
to,
have those big boxes now that they
you gotta
sell.
You got to throw them out.
I see them and I quickly avert my eyes because I...
it's too painful.
It's too painful. Ann Patchett, her new book, State of Wonder, and she'll be at Corte Madera's Book Passage today at noon and tonight at Menlo Park's Kepler's Books, 7 o'clock. Thank you so much.
I had a great time. It's good to see you.
Always good to see you. Yeah. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Always remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us forum@kqed.org or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. In fact, you can continue this conversation by doing just that. And also, you can let us know what you think about programs or suggest programs to us by calling our toll-free number, 415. Well, it's not toll-free. It's 415-553-3300. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.